As it expanded, Exxon refined its own foreign, security, and economic policies. In some of the faraway countries where it did business, because of the scale of its investments, Exxon's sway over local politics and security was greater than that of the United States Embassy. In impoverished African countries increasingly important to Exxon's strategy, such as Chad, the weight of the corporation's investments and the cash flow it shared with local governments overwhelmed the economy and became the central prize in violent local contests for power. In Moscow and Beijing, Exxon's independent power and negotiating agenda competed with and sometimes attracted more attention than the démarche issued by American secretaries of state. Yet the corporation could also be insular and even passive in the faraway places where it acquired and produced oil and gas. It fenced off local operations and separated its workforce and operations from upheaval outside its gates. If its oil flowed and its contract terms remained intact, then Exxon often followed a directive of minimal interference in local politics, especially if those politics were controversial, as in the case of the African dictatorships with which the corporation partnered, or the countries such as Indonesia and Venezuela, where civil conflict swirled around Exxon properties. In Washington, Exxon was a more confident and explicit political actor. The corporation's lobbyists bent and shaped American foreign policy, as well as economic, climate, chemical, and environmental regulation. Exxon maintained all-weather alliances with sympathetic American politicians while calling as little attention to its influence as possible. The Cold War's end signaled a coming era when non-governmental actors, corporations, philanthropies, terrorist cells, and media networks all gained relative power. Exxon's size, insularity, and ideology made its position distinct. Unlike Walmart or Google, to name two other multinational corporations that would rise after 1989 to global influence, the object of Exxon's business model lay buried beneath the earth. Exxon drilled holes in the ground and then operated its oil and gas wells for many years, and so its business imperatives were linked to the control of physical territory. Increasingly, the oil and gas Exxon produced was located in poor or unstable countries. Its treasure was subject to capture or political theft by coup makers or guerrilla movements, and so the corporation became involved in small wars and kidnapping rackets that many other international companies could gratefully avoid. The time horizons for Exxon's investments stretched out longer than those of almost any government it lobbied. "We see governments come and go," Lee Raymond once remarked, an observation that was particularly true of Washington with its constitutionally term-limited presidency. Exxon's investments in a particular oil and gas field could be premised on a production lifespan of 40 or more years. During that time, the United States might change its president and its foreign and energy policies at least half a dozen times. Overseas, a project's host country might pass through multiple coups and political upheavals during the same four decades. It behooved Exxon to develop influence and lobbying strategies to manage or evade political volatility. American spies and diplomats, who occasionally migrated to work at Exxon, discovered a corporate system of secrecy, non-disclosure agreements, and internal security that matched some of the most compartmented black boxes of the world's intelligence agencies. The corporation's information control systems guarded proprietary industrial data, but also sought to protect its long-term strategic position by minimizing its visibility. Exxon's executives deflected press coverage. They withheld cooperation from congressional investigators, if the letter of the law allowed, and they typically spoke in public by reading out sanitized, carefully edited speeches or PowerPoint slides. Their strategy worked. Exxon made a fetish of rules, but it rarely had to justify or explain publicly how it operated when the rules were gray. As the Valdez wreck made obvious, Exxon's massive daily operations, soon to produce 1.5 billion barrels of oil and gas pumped from the ground each year and 50 billion gallons of gasoline sold worldwide, posed huge environmental risks. After the Valdez, Exxon would become again, as it had been in the first decades of Standard Oil's existence, the most hated oil company in America. When gasoline prices soared, American commuters felt powerless before its influence. In effect, Exxon was America's energy policy. Certainly there was no governmental policy of comparable coherence. After fitful, failed efforts to wean itself from imported oil during the 1970s, the United States had evolved no effective government-led energy strategy. Its de facto policy was the operation of free markets amid a jumble of patchwork subsidies, contradictory rules, and weak regulatory agencies. The very weakness of policy favored Exxon. As the public's frustration grew over rising pump prices and dependence on oil imports that transferred billions of dollars to hostile regimes overseas, Exxon became a natural lightning rod. The corporation managed this criticism with the same cool-headed patience and indifference that it employed to endure political risk in tin-pot African dictatorships. Compromise was not the Exxon way.